I'd forgotten about the spell. My relief lasts only a second, though, since the next thing I hear is a whistle. Out of the corner of my eye, I see a van pull up, but just as I register what the words painted on the side, NO Sanitation Squad, actually mean, sanitation as in wiped out, as in one of the ones infamous death squads, a billy club smashes into my right temple. My vision returns just in time to see a steel-toed boot connect with my abdomen, knocking the wind out of me and making me feel like I could puke up a kidney, or all of my large and small intestines. The crowd pulses and sways in front of me as a man with a greasy black mustache and thin little lips, seemingly the leader, yanks my hair back, his cold eyes inches from my face. "By order of the One," he spits, reading from an official-looking paper, "all scum shall hereby be clean from these orderly streets, including practitioners of the forbidden dark or expressive arts, those individuals formerly known as celebrities, and all others posing a threat to the integrity of the new order." He scowls, taking in my mask of Brandon Michael Hatfield's chiseled features, apparently almost as offensive as my real identity. "And that includes you, scum." I manage to cough up enough phlegm to douse him with a good spray in return, which I'll probably regret in about 5 seconds. The other death squaddies move in, and now the real party begins. One yanks my arms behind my back while two more take turns, kneading my face into pizza dough, blood pouring from my nose like marinara. Things are happening too fast for me to register the pain of each injury, but as I'm wrenched to the side, I definitely feel my bad shoulder dislocate from its socket, the bright pain shooting through me like an axe. I could attempt to hurl a spell at them to hold them off, but something tells me that life will be much, much worse if they know who I really am. I try to focus on something else, besides the fists raining down on me, but the only other thing I can see is the murderous mob just beyond the soldiers' circle. A woman in a mink stole and garish lipstick shouts at them to "finish him off," and the image of the witch's smoking corpse flashes in my memory. I'm not ready to be finished off quite yet, even with Celia waiting for me in the Shadowland. Celia. The thought of her is like another kick to the gut, but imagining her sweet smile and her warmth, and remembering exactly who took her from me, is enough for some vengeful spells to come to mind. There's no choice now but to rely on the magic, which is pretty, well, stressful considering point and click hasn't exactly been working for me lately. Seals, I might be seeing you sooner than I thought. Chapter 14. I'm not much more than a bloody pulp on the ground at this point, but I hurl every ounce of magic I've got left in me at these brutes. I'm mumbling through chants and curses and poems, forcing out everything negative I can muster. And it's kind of terrifying. I feel this dark energy building within me, growing into a power that needs to get out and find a target. I finish with a poem that always seemed particularly gruesome. "No more a flashing eye. No more a sonorous voice or springy step. Now some slave's eye, voice, hands, step. A drunkard's breath, unwholesome eater's face, venereal lees flesh. Lungs rotting away piecemeal, stomach sour and cankerous. Joints rheumatic, bowels clogged with abomination." Before I can finish Wallace Shipton's words, the New Order thugs double over, spewing their lunches across their shiny black boots, and blood dribbles out of the citizens' lips, staining their fine clothes. "The blood plague," I slur through swollen lips. "They're all contaminated!" When this registers, the citizens and squatties, equally panicked, quickly and brutally turn on one another. I limp away from the chaos just as the beatings start, soldiers and business people scrabbling like dogs, all trying to go for the jugular. I pause for a second on the corner, listening to the cries coming from the alley. Guilt at having created even more violence eats at me. This isn't the sort of work the prophecies intended, I'm sure of it. I hesitate and consider going back to heal them all. Then I think of that pitiful, blackened form, strapped to the stake, and my heart hardens with a bitter new understanding of the world we're living in. Let them destroy one another. I allow my disguise to fall away as I walk, but somehow I still don't feel like myself.
Chapter 15. There's no power, and outside, the soldiers of the New Order occupation continue to brutalize the citizenry. But inside the Niederman's candlelit basement hovel, the spirit of the holiday season warms us right down to our souls. And it's been a very long time since Whit and I felt anything resembling spiritual warmth. Mama May flashes her biggest smile at all of us and bangs on a bucket to signal that the meal is ready. An excited murmur goes through the room. "Come on, come on! Everybody gather around!" Mama May booms excitedly. "We've got a very special feast day celebration tonight. Something we haven't had in almost a month. Meat!" A cheer erupts from the group, and the starving Niederman family members settle into a circle on the floor, looking up expectantly. Mama May reveals two poorly plucked pigeons, skinny as sparrows. They look like another family has already picked them over. I stare at Whit pointedly. "It looks delicious, Mama," Pearl says with authority, and everyone murmurs in polite agreement. Mama May kisses the top of Pearl's head and starts hacking into the birds. And I know I should be grateful, and I know I should honor their tradition, but I see the sadness in all of these big, silver eyes, and the hunger in these thin, strained faces, and I just can't take it. I start to say something, but Whit puts a hand on my arm and shakes his head. He's been weird and moody since he came back from begging. He was limping and bleeding, but wouldn't say why. In fact, he's barely said a word to anyone all night. I'm about to tell him that he's seriously cramping the holiday vibe, but then he does something wonderful. With a flick of my brother's wrist, we've got thick rolls drenched in butter and mashed potatoes full of sour cream. An oversized turkey dominates the middle of the circle, and cream corn edges up on green beans. And the pie. Apple, pumpkin, pecan. I could eat pie for the rest of my life. The kids are all talking at once, and the adults are looking too dumbstruck to really believe it. I beam at Whit excitedly, but he's not smiling. Instead, he's watching Pearl, who's still slicing at the tough pigeon meat on her plate, her mouth twisted into that tight little knot I keep spotting on her face. No one moves to touch anything before Mama May's say-so, and I can tell Whit's as nervous as I am. But Mama's round face glows, candlelight dancing in her eyes, and her broad grin puts me at ease. "I can't tell you how much this means to our family. We've lost so much." She looks around at each hollow-cheeked kid and takes a deep breath. "I just want you all to know that this really is the best feast day we've ever had." I think of past holidays with food I never really tasted, presents I can't even remember, cutting out of family time early to do one thing or another. I squeeze my brother's hand. "It's the best for us, too," I whisper. Chapter 16. After dinner, Whit keeps pushing for us to just take off, leaving the Niedermans behind. I gawk at him. "Now? You're not serious. It's the feast day." He chews his lip. "Whist, you haven't been outside in a while. You don't know how it is. Things are getting more dangerous." There's something different in his voice that I can't place. He looks away from me, but he's already gathering our things. "Well, then there'll be more NO guards around now than ever, won't there?" I point out. "Besides, I'm barely over the plague." I try to look frail. Using my near-death experience is a little manipulative, but it's true nonetheless. Can't we just enjoy this semblance of happy tradition a tiny bit longer? My eyes plead. Wit huffs and stalks away, but I know I've at least bought us some time. Still, later, as the Niedermans exchange their holiday gifts, I almost wish we had left and avoided intruding on their intimate family moment. Wit and I try to give them space, cleaning up the dishes on the sidelines, but it's hard not to stare at their thoughtful handmade presents. Metal trinkets they unearthed while scavenging, rocks polished smooth, drumsticks whittled from scrap wood by hand. My heart clenches at the unexpected reminder of the gift my mom once gave me. Just then, Pearl Marie runs up to us, a ball of excitement. She's holding out a garbage bag tied with string for each of us. I take mine, raising an eyebrow at Wit. What are you waiting for? The fall of the new order? Open it already, Pearl squeals. At the bottom of each giant garbage bag is a single strand of silver tinsel. I'm not quite sure what to do with it, but Pearl's eyes shimmer expectantly, and Wit's face lights up. I haven't seen him smile this wide since before we were first kidnapped. Thanks, kid. This really means a lot. From the way Wit's acting, it's clear how precious this scraggly stuff is to her, and how tough it must have been to give it up. Yeah, well, I figured you might need a little sparkle for that ugly mug, Pearl says, straight-faced. Come here, smart stuff, Wit yells, scooping her up and tossing her in the air. Pearl shrieks her high hyena laugh, and it's almost like we're a family. Family. Suddenly, I miss my parents so much I can almost feel them in the room with me. We were together not so long ago, but it already seems like forever since I've heard their voices. Voices that the one silenced for good. Before I can turn away, Mama May spots the hot, salty tears rushing down my cheeks. Her strong arms envelop me in a crushing hug. I know how it is, sweet pea. Everything's changing, and this time of year is the hardest. So many traditions lost, so many people dead. It used to be the season for getting together, loving your neighbor. Would you believe we couldn't even find a meeting place to read the holiday legends? It's a disgrace, is what it is. She's absent-mindedly combing her fingers through my hair as she talks, like I've seen her do with her children. I normally hate to have my hair touched, but it's surprisingly soothing to feel her strong hands kneading my scalp. I feel safe. What about the hall? That's where my family always heard the readings, I say, tracing my hand along the neat braid she somehow made of my tangled strands. It's gotten a lot worse lately, Hewitt explains, walking up with Wit. He hands each of us a dessert plate heaped with pie. They're cracking down on anyone caught believing in any greater power other than his. After all those people were executed in the square last month, the hall is pretty much defunct. Mama May shakes her head and sets aside her pie slice untouched. Besides, you can't find anybody who'll say a strong word against him anymore, let alone folks who want to pray for better days. Her eyes are brimming. Pearl tugs at her mother's dingy dress. Don't cry, Mama. Look what God got us anyway. Nothing but sickness and death. The One is the only being I can see who has any control in this world. Mama May gasps at the forbidden name, but Pearl continues. Who knows anyway? Maybe the One is God.
Chapter 17. Isn't she something? The one who is the One says to the man behind him, his eyes still locked on the small screen. While others rot from the plague, like sewer rats, still the gift prevails. The One's young protege sighs and stalks across the room, his polished soldier's boots echoing on the metal floor. He is tallish, no more than 17, and his straight-backed posture and sour, pursed lips hint at a strict upbringing among the very wealthy. His dazzlingly convincing smile and his straight white teeth make him a living poster for the clean, optimistic New Order. With white blonde hair combed severely back from his forehead, pale blue, almost clear eyes, and prominent cheekbones, he seems made of glass, sharp and colorless, beautiful but hard, cold. His name is Pierce. Pierce surveys the rows upon rows of surveillance screens that light up the control tower, showing every corner of the compound. With a tap of his fingertip, the one can incinerate any of the children pictured. He often does so for sport on lazy afternoons. But the one's attention is focused on a different monitor now, one depicting a scene far across the Capitol. Pierce peers over the one's shoulder at the group of filthy-looking individuals passing around candles in a tiny, dank room. The girl is there, the one's precious, chosen one, standing among them. Alive. Pierce follows the one's gaze to the fire roaring in the corner. "It's barely a spark," the soldier says with disdain. "Ah, but the power of a single spark," the one smiles, amused. "You didn't find it so easy, as I recall," he notes. When Pierce remains bitterly silent, the one clears his throat. "I have to say, I'm growing a bit impatient at this point," he says lightly, as if commenting on the weather or the civilian death toll. "Was I not clear when I said I wanted her captured?" "The squad and the mutts are on their way," Pierce replies, with cool confidence. The one presses his lips together. "Ah, so am I to understand that you employed demonstrably incompetent idiots to do a job that I brought you here specifically to do?" Pierce runs his fingers through his hair in frustration. The trouble is, the thought of getting close to Wisty Allgood stirs intensely conflicting emotions in him, and he is not one accustomed to feeling much emotion at all. "Couldn't we just kill her?" Pierce suggests. The words are out before he can stop them. The one raises an eyebrow, and Pierce sees his grave blunder. "It would be easier, faster," he explains quickly. "Without the existence of the gift, there's no threat. We'll have all the power there is to have." The one stands up and stares down at Pierce as if seeing him for the first time. His mouth twists into a sour grimace. Then, without a word, the one strikes Pierce hard across the face. The blow makes the boy stumble backward and leaves a deep gash where the one's spiked ring with the New Order insignia has caught Pierce's high, chiseled cheekbone. Blood is dripping onto the floor in bright, vivid exclamations, but Pierce doesn't cry out, and his jaw is still hard, defiant. After all, in his short life, he's been dealt much worse. "You've developed a bit of a stutter, my boy." "I think you mean I'll have the power, don't you?" the one says evenly. "And I don't see much of a threat, really. More like an interesting little game we're all playing." Then the one turns away from Pierce dismissively and goes back to gazing at the screen. Pierce feels a familiar fury heat up his cheeks and his ears, moving all the way down to his fingertips. There is only one person in the world whom he hates more than the witch. The young soldier reaches a tentative hand toward the one. If he is strong enough, if he has it in him, he will have no better opportunity. An inch or two more, and he can touch that smooth, bald head, watch the skin peel away from the skull and the body collapse. Hand shaking, he hesitates. The one whirls around, and at the same time Pierce jerks upward, as if choked by an invisible vice. "Getting a little ahead of ourselves, aren't we?" the one laughs maniacally. "Gunning for game over already?" Pierce's legs dangle as he's suspended inches above the floor, and his face quickly grows crimson and bloated. "You wouldn't," he sputters. The one's technicolor eyes dance with wickedness as he holds Pierce aloft by an invisible noose. "As you know too well, dear boy, there is virtually nothing I wouldn't do to educate those who don't completely understand my authority." Pierce looks past the one and thinks he can just make out the white-topped mountains in the distance, mocking him. The Wizard King's domain. He never should have left. Just as he is losing consciousness, Pierce falls abruptly to the floor in a pitiful heap. "Now," says the one, softly, leaning over him, "bring me the girl." His smoldering eyes flash a warning. "Please." Pierce's breath comes in jagged gasps as he struggles to his feet. Regaining his composure, he salutes, turns sharply, and strides as confidently as he can manage toward the door. "And Pierce?" the one says, when the youth is almost out of the room. Pierce stops in the doorway, his nerves buzzing. "Remember who made you what you are. If you want to go back to the mountains, I can take away every ounce of power I gave you." Pierce's body goes rigid, but he doesn't turn around. He touches his cheek and finds it still wet with blood. Biting his tongue to keep from screaming, he straightens, wipes his hand on the doorknob, and goes out to find Wisty Allgood. Chapter 18. I'm a wanted fugitive, a criminal of the highest order whose mug is plastered on every wall, every lamppost in the capital. Considering how insane things are right now, getting up at 5 in the morning, tramping through a city crawling with soldiers, using a big chunk of my M to conspicuously morph my arm into an axe, and hacking down a tree in the middle of Overland Park on a banned holiday is probably one of the riskiest, stupidest things I could do. It's not even a great tree. It's a little sparse around the back, and it leans dramatically to the left. But seeing the look on my sister's face as she and Pearl drape scraggly tinsel over its branches makes the trip totally worth it. Pearl hasn't said much to me yet, but her eyes are shining with emotion. She looks at Wisty and nods her chin in the direction of the fireplace. "Pretty good fire you've got burning there. Been going for almost 2 days now." Wisty grins. Coming from Pearl, this is high praise. I want to join in their moment, but at the mention of the fire, I've got that charred corpse in my head again. I feel nauseated. Wisty catches my expression and looks perplexed. As much as I want to tell her about what I witnessed in that alley, more than anything, I just want to forget it and get my sister far away from the capital. Wisty, on the other hand, wants to draw out this holiday for as long as possible. She winks at me and Pearl, and in a moment the broken ornaments, sitting crudely on the branches, transform into a rainbow of winking electrical lights, the colors glowing in the dark room. I whistle in appreciation, and the other Niedermans gather around, the kids oohing and aahing. I smile at Pearl, but her tiny face is a mask. Mama May coughs. "Pearl Marie, honey, where are your manners? What do you say?" Pearl's big gray eyes are solemn. "It's great, really pretty and all. It's beautiful." She looks at both of us accusingly. "But if you're who you say you are, if you've come to save us, can't you do something more?" "Pearl," Mama cuts in, anger creeping into her voice. "I'm sorry, Wisty. She's just upset. With Ziggy's death and all." "Yeah, Mama, they've given us some twinkly ornaments. But I worked hard for those pieces of broken glass. What has she ever worked for?" Wisty stares at the floor, and I put an arm around her shoulders. "And the feast day was terrific. But we're going to be hungry again tomorrow, and the day after that. Can they keep this whole family warm at night? Warm and safe?" Pearl asks. "Every night?" No one says a word. Every sound has been sucked out of the room. Pearl Marie's eyes are burning into us, holding us accountable. Right then, there's an ear-splitting explosion of splintering wood, and the door caves in. A dizzying number of Death Squad recruits flood into the space, their black boots like rats, scurrying over one another, their weapons trained on the space between our eyes. I was almost getting too comfortable for a second there. This is more like my life. I look around frantically for a weapon, or a way out of this situation. But there are too many soldiers and too many guns, and too many snarling, biting wolves, their mangy coats reeking of rotting flesh, bloodlust in their eyes. There's a moment of silence, and nobody moves. It's like the Death Squad didn't really expect that it would be so easy. We are animals caught in a trap, staring into the face of our demise. Where can we go? My mind races with my pulse, and I sense my sister next to me, tensed, ready to spring on my cue. Pearl looks mesmerized by the wolves, her small body literally shaking. "Stick with Mama May," I whisper. "Don't look back. Just go." "Under the direct order of the one who is the one," a chubby recruit reads from a ledger, "the members of this household are to be placed under arrest for the despicable deeds of harboring high-risk fugitives and practicing those forbidden acts and readings associated with what was formerly known as the holiday, punishable by execution in Orderly Square." The Niedermen seem resigned through their tears. They knew this day would come. "Nice tree," one soldier says flatly, sneering. "Sturdy wood, Pine. Should work nicely for your hanging gallows." They lunge forward, and chaos erupts. The Niedermen seem to have disappeared, and in their place is a frenzied group of scattering mice. Some of the soldiers are stomping at the floor, and one phobic guy is shrieking in fear. Wisty winks at me, and in an instant, I'm reminded that when it comes to morphing things, rodents are her specialty. In the pandemonium, we're able to dart past the soldiers and up the crumbling staircase to the destroyed apartments above. Hell's beasts snapping at our heels. Frantic, dizzy, we circle up and up. I haven't considered what we'll do when we reach the top, when the staircase just ends. The next floor is bombed out, and the only thing that stands between us and the bloody snarling jaws of the wolves is a shattered window. One of the men laughs as his wolf strains against the chains. "End of the line. Where else are you gonna go?" "Now would be the time for a hawk spell," I say to Wisty. This is when we'd typically morph smoothly into graceful winged creatures, taking flight and soaring above this red-bannered city, our pursuers nothing but tiny black smudges on the landscape below. Yet, here we still are. Human. Wisty sighs in frustration. "My power's shorting out or something. It's like it works on other people, but not on us." Without a spell, without a choice, I tackle Wisty, and together we tumble out of the fourth-story window, falling, falling, and then a crushing thud.
Chapter 19. Whit and I stand up, coughing, panting, and a little bruised but victorious. I glance, bewildered, at the enormous pile of trash that broke our fall, and an old woman nods at me as she walks away down the demolished street, trying to look inconspicuous. A small sign of support and unity. We are not the only ones still battling this unjust system. The soldiers lean out the window, bellowing insults, but they can't get to us. "So why are these NO men grinning?" I squint up at the window. They've got something small and angry squirming between them. They've got Pearl Marie! She struggles against them, her little face fierce with determination. But the men laugh, yanking her arms back and forth. "You forgot your little pet," one jeers at us. "We could toss her down to you." He dangles Pearl out the window as she screams. "But I think we'll just hang on to her for now. You know, for safekeeping." "You didn't change her too?" Whit whispers angrily at me. "I thought I changed them all," I say, irritated. "There's no way I could have missed her." "She must have slipped out before then," Whit sighs. "She was terrified of those wolves. I told her to stick with Mama May and run. We'll have to find her after we've got our energy back and built up the resistance forces." He turns, and I look up to see Pearl's distraught face at the crumbling window, struggling against the pull of her captors. "We're not just gonna leave her," I demand. "I can't believe what I'm hearing. Back in the days of the resistance, we never would have left someone behind." "What choice do we have?" Whit asks, his voice strained with emotion. "You know I care about that kid, Wist. It isn't safe here for you. For us. I just got you back, and I'm not ready to lose you again." Whit looks up at little Pearl Marie. "We'll come back for you," he yells. "We promise, and we always keep our promises." I catch sight of her brave nod as the guards sweep her away and swiftly down the stairwell, I'm assuming toward us. Resentfully, I dashed down the alley of rubble after my brother, mice fleeing in our path. After we've been running for what seems like forever, I turn to Wit, still angry. "That's not true, what you said," I tell him. He looks at me, confused. "What's not true? I didn't say anything." "That stuff you told Pearl Marie when we ran away like cowards, when we left her there at the mercy of those goons," I say bitterly. "You said we always keep our promises." "Who have we made promises to, Wit?" "Celia, the resistance kids, Mom and Dad." Wit's face flushes, but he remains silent. "A big help we've been to all of them, big brother. We shouldn't be making promises to anybody, not to a single soul, and especially not to that doomed little girl." Chapter 20. "Got to stop going to barf," I wheeze. I slow to a halt next to a closed fast food joint, and my brother, who's way ahead, jogs back to me. It's almost nightfall, and we're not even out of the capital, but the plague has weakened me more than I want to admit. There's a huge neon sign blinking the Wonderburgers logo. "The one is forever. Consume happily." I'm doubled over, but I turn to cough some phlegm in its direction. Wit's eyes are full of concern. "You okay, sis? I'm fine stopping for the night. You're looking a little wrecked." I shake my head. "I'll be okay. I just need to catch my breath. It'd be nice if we could just fly or something." "Your M's still acting up?" Wit's frowning at me. I roll my eyes. "I know, okay? It was dumb to waste all that energy on a weak fire and holiday lights so soon after being sick. And now my mojo's weak and blah, blah, blah." "No, that's not what I mean. I don't think it's the plague messing with your magic. It's happening to me now, too. And I had trouble with spells before, when you were still unconscious. It's the air out here or something that's blocking it." "Huh," I say, sitting down on the curb next to an appallingly expensive black car, its seats littered with Wonderburger wrappers. "So we're in the middle of a capital crawling with Death Squad soldiers, the one who is the one has a price on our heads, and neither of us has any magic to help us out of this mess? Didn't you just whip up a whole holiday feast and, like, cut down a tree with your arm?" I mime a chopping action and accidentally hit the black car. The alarm goes off, its plaintive wail cutting into the still night air. My adrenaline surges, and we sprint over to hide behind the Wonderburger dumpster. But there's not a soul around to respond, and soon the repetitive howl cuts off. Wit shoots me an annoyed look and steps out from behind the dumpster. Then he jumps right back into our conversation. "I felt strong in the Niederman's basement, and I was okay if I stayed relatively close. But the farther away we get from that positive energy, it's like a switch has been flipped, and I'm about as powerful as a mosquito." "Looks like our only chance is to get our power from other people," I say. "What do you mean?" Wit's looking at me like I just read his mind, and he's not super comfortable with it. The blinking light from the Wonderburger sign gives his face an eerie hue. "Strength in numbers, right?" I touch Wit's arm, thinking aloud. "The only thing that beats one is two, and three, and four. You said we'd go back for Pearl once we built up the resistance forces again. I vote we try to find Janine, Emmett, Sasha, Jamila, everyone we can track down, to help out." Wit shakes his head like he's about to deliver some really bad news. "They're all on the missing persons list. Hewitt showed me a copy he'd somehow gotten hold of." "So?" I challenge. I sound angrier than I mean to. "So that means there's no resistance anymore." He's rubbing his forehead like he does when he's frustrated and upset. He looks me in the eyes, measuring his words. It means they're probably all dead, Whist. We're all that's left. My brother's trying to control his emotion, to keep his face strong. To anyone else, he'd look calm, resigned. But I'm his sister, and I can hear that slight quiver in his voice. I can see the small twitch of muscles around his mouth. He's remembering them. I know he's thinking of Janine, and the way she took charge of the resistance with unending compassion and capability after Margot was killed, sending in more and more rescue teams to get captured kids out of the prisons, even as the bombs rained down. Or maybe he's remembering the look she used to give him, the intimate, adoring gaze that he pretended never to notice, but that we all could see as plain as day. He'd been the only one who could crack her shell. But maybe the new order finally broke her. Like me, Whit's probably thinking of Sasha with his dark curly hair, stubborn and strong-willed, but with more revolutionary fight in him than anyone. Or of kind, level-headed Emmett, the gentle giant who my brother knew would always have my back if he wasn't around, who said I looked awesome, even when I hacked off all my hair to stay off the radar. I cross my arms and walk a couple of paces, thinking of my lost friends and feeling the bubble of grief well up and lodge itself in my throat. Then I turn around. We owe them more than this, more than just letting them go. The one controls that list, right? I ask. Whit nods. I'm anxious, talking faster and pacing the parking lot even though I'm dead tired from running all day. Well, just because he doesn't know where they are doesn't mean they're not still alive. Whit's brow crinkles as he considers this possibility. His face struggles between hope and defeat. But if the one can't find them, how are we going to? They could be anywhere by now. I think for a minute. The last time we saw Emmett and Janine was in that underground steam pipe after Garfunkel's was blown up. Before we got separated, right? Whit shrugs, but I see the doubt on his face. So we start looking by going back there. Maybe they turned it into the new Resistance HQ. It's not likely, but it's possible, right? All right, Captain Wisteria. If you say we'll find him, I guess we'll find him. Whit punches me playfully, but I know he's trying to downplay just how much this outcome matters. Viva la Resistance! He does an energetic lap around the parking lot, ready to sprint to the steam pipe right now. Only, Whit, I call after him. Yeah? I'm not quite ready for another all-night journey through the lion's den of the New Order just yet. I think I'll take you up on that offer to find some place to sleep first. Whit bangs on the side of the dumpster. The mealy, gag-inducing stench of rotting meat is wafting over from here. Oh no, I'm so not going to... Got a better idea? My know-it-all brother asks. He plants his hand and vaults his legs over in a graceful move even I have to admire. My brother has always been athletic, but in the weeks we were apart, he must have been training on his own non-stop. He's gotten, as Celia would say, seriously ripped. I scramble in after him. As much as I don't want to lay my head to rest among the scraps of the New Order citizenry's garbage, it's strangely fitting, actually. Kind of poetic. It's also sheltered, and out of the way. And, as my brother has already discovered, full of food. Well, if you can call food a quarter pound of deep-fried meat that consists of the body parts of hundreds of different animals and is now discarded in a crumpled bag in the bottom of a dumpster. Whit sees my expression and shrugs. I'm starving, he says, chomping off a chunk of a half-eaten Wonder Biggie burger. Three words. Disgusting. My stomach complains loudly, and Whit grins, holding the bag out to me. Happy holiday, my brother says, mouthful. Reluctantly, I reach into the sack. But the only thing left in this bag is a kid's plastic action figure of the one, bald head shining in the weak light of the dumpster. My temper simmers, and I melt the one down to nothing in my hand.
"Whoa," says Wit. "You've got some mojo in you after all."
I shake my head. "That's not mojo. That's just pure hatred."
Chapter 21.
Wit, baby? Can you hear me?
I wake, or think I wake, to the sweetest voice I've ever heard. Her face, her perfect, beautiful face, is just inches from mine, and I swear if my heart stopped beating right now, I'd die happy. Her long dark curls frame her face, and she's looking into my eyes in that calm, unself-conscious way that always did me in. I hold my breath and inhale her scent. If this is a dream, I never want to wake up.
Seals, is that really you?
I so want it to be you. Chasing Celia's image has gotten me into trouble before, and Wistie's convinced it's the one trying to manipulate me. If so, I have to admit, he's using the right angle. Celia's the one thing I can't say no to. I'd probably run into a snarling pile of zombie wolves if she asked me to. Celia surveys the dumpster. Nice digs you got here, baby. A little fancier than the Shadowland, I'll give you that. But I have to say, you smell worse than a herd of lost ones. She wriggles her nose in mock disgust. I grin. That's my girl. I reach out to touch her face, her smooth, soft skin, and she turns her cheek, mimes kissing my hand even though it's only air. My heart aches. She's never felt more real, but moments like this don't last very long. Oh, I almost forgot, Celia reaches into her pocket. I brought you a present for the holiday, she says, and smiles in that way of hers, shyly, that brings back a rush of memories so potent I almost can't take it. The first time she placed her hand in mine, her slender fingers so warm, her face when I scored the winning touchdown, the day she first introduced me as her boyfriend, the first time I saw her as a ghost after she disappeared. She places the object in my hand, and I can actually feel it. It's a fountain pen, sleek, shiny, perfectly crafted, just like Celia. I've never used one of these, but I can't wait to try it. Celia, this is beautiful, I say, turning over the pen in my hands. She smiles, pleased. It's not as old school as it seems, really. You can write with it anywhere, on any surface, and it'll record your words wherever you want. You can write your story no matter where the one forces you to run. I'll write your story, too, I vow. But suddenly, Celia's eyes look far away, like she's reading from a letter. And Wit, there's something else I have for you. A message. From your parents. My heart seizes up. If my parents can still contact us through Celia, if we can still communicate, it's as if they're not really gone.
My parents? You've seen them?
I manage.
Your dad said to remind you. You and Wistie need to share your gifts if you're going to get anywhere. And your mom said to be brave, and not to be afraid to let go.
Celia smiles sadly. But you and I both know you're not very good at letting go, right, baby? The air around her is cold, way colder than it should be. She's leaving. She's always leaving. I jerk awake and bump my head against the metal of the dumpster. My hand, still reaching for Celia, is thrown over the side and is freezing in the night air. Hopelessness floods through me. I love her so freaking much. But what's the use in loving someone so fiercely who is dead? I'm clutching something in my other hand, clutching it for dear life. The pen. I must have created it from the dream. Apparently I've got some M left after all.
Chapter 22.
Wit, wait up, Wistie whines.
We're on the outskirts of the City of Progress, and I'm barreling ahead of my sister on streets where New Order confiscated middle-class homes jockey for space among abandoned, dilapidated buildings.
I know neither Wisty nor I got the best night's sleep behind Wonder Barfer, but sometimes, when an idea strikes, you just gotta move on it. There are few armed soldiers this far out, but I can still hear the shrill howls of dogs scrabbling in the distance, dogs that have been trained on our scent, mobs probably lurking in every alleyway, eager to burn us to ashes. We have to keep moving, and now that I have a destination in mind, I want to get there as soon as possible. Wisty jogs to catch up. I thought we agreed we were going to head to the steam pipe. You're going the wrong way. I know, but I was thinking we'd take a little detour first. Wisty stops and crosses her arms, and I clear my throat. A short trip to the clinic where you volunteered with those sick kids, for example? Wisty doesn't say anything. She's probably thinking of her still healing scabs and the terrifying, fever-induced delusions she endured when she almost died just a few days ago. I don't blame her. It's just that I can't get that message from our parents, from Celia, out of my head, even if it was all a dream. Don't kill me. Listen, when I used my M to heal you, I felt this amazing relief to have you back. But there was something else, too. It felt right, like healing was exactly what my magic was meant for. She leans against a rusting chain-link fence and examines the blister on her heel. She looks up, eyebrows raised, impatient. Then I had this crazy dream, and I'm just starting to get this feeling that we should be doing more. And if I can help a few sick kids to get better and grow up to keep fighting against the one, that doesn't seem like such a bad thing. I expect Wisty to protest at least a little, but she nods thoughtfully. Yeah, after what Pearl said about fulfilling the prophecy, I've been thinking about what we can do to help too. I do want to find the resistance members if there's a chance. But the steam pipe area is likely toxic, heavily guarded, or both. Who knows? Maybe someone at the clinic has heard something about our friends. Great, I say, relieved. Let's get going then, slowpoke. I take off. Wit? Wisty calls after me. Yeah? It's in the other direction. Chapter 23. As we near the center, it's like I can feel the power within me growing. Seeing all of these people in need in one place seems to help reopen the channels of magic that the one's influence has shut down. I look to my sister, and I don't even have to ask. I feel it too, she says. I think I might even have enough juice to do a morph. Might be safer. Disguised as middle-aged hospital staff, we head into the clinic, which is in an old parking garage from the days before the new order restricted vehicle use for officials only. Wisty's rocking a blonde perm and a fake tan, and I look like the once popular comedian Mark Dark, all scruff and slouch. I make a mental note to keep up my workout routine into my 40s. The paunch is not working for me. Inside, it's way worse than I expected, and apparently a whole lot worse than when Wisty was last here. For one, it's all kids. Moaning, bleeding, dying kids. Kids on filthy cots or sprawled on mats on the floor among the decades-old auto grease. Wisty gasps, her hand covering her mouth. We've seen a lot under this brutal regime, but this is too much. It's the one who is the one's latest cleansing program, a nurse says from behind us. Her face is lined with worry, and she looks like she hasn't slept in weeks. Or at least that's what the rumor is. The new order wants to expand its fancy headquarters into the old town, and the youth in that district seem especially tough to convert. So if the cleansing can take out a few thousand young potential dissenters in the process, that's just icing on the cake. I want to hit someone. That's not accurate. I don't want to hit just anyone. Just one person. I want to bash his bald head in. Let's get on with it, Wisty says bitterly, and I know she's just trying to keep it together. She still knows her way around the clinic and heads to the end with the youngest kids, where the floor starts to slant up to the next level. A young nurse named Lenora, whom Wisty recognizes, nods to us as we gather bandages. We help her move a few of the delirious kids from the floor to free cots. They feel like tiny birds in my arms, hearts racing. There's never enough beds, Lenora huffs, wiping the sweat from her freckled forehead. We try to keep the sickest off the floor, but the plague seems to be mutating. She unwraps a toddler's soiled, unsightly dressings and uses fresh gauze to cover the sores, cooing to him as he cries. Before some had a chance, the fighters could pull through. Now it takes almost every single one, and quickly. These children aren't in good shape, but those over there are faring the worst. If you can stomach it, what they could really use is someone to hold their hands. All any of them wants is a mother. We walk over to where she's pointing. It's darker and quieter. The kids don't talk or cry in this part of the garage. There's only the sound of labored, shallow breathing. Wisty is pressing her lips together, her face pale. I know she'd hold every single kid's hand as he died if it would help, but I'm hoping we can do better than that. The first patient we visit is a little boy with sallow skin and the telltale plague scabs on his face. His big brown eyes are still lucid as they peer at us, but they're shot with red. He doesn't say anything as I put my hands on his shoulders, just sucks his thumb and squeezes his eyes shut against the pain. I don't want to think about what has happened to his mother. I nod to my sister, and she places her hands over mine. For a moment, nothing happens, and worry fills my chest. But then I feel the jolt of energy as our power surges into this boy. We watch in awe as his breathing evens out and the red drains from his eyes. I can't believe that actually worked, Wisty gapes. I shrug self-consciously. But then the boy smiles up at me, and I feel like God. Wisty and I get a sort of assembly line of healing going, and while we're not able to save everyone, some of them are too far gone. In just a short while, we've got half the clinic on the way to better. Each healing process takes a lot out of me, and I can feel my energy draining. But when I put my hands on these kids' frail shoulders and feel the M flow into them, it's nothing short of incredible. My fingertips heat up, and my heart, and I feel this surge of, I can't explain it, light, energy, warmth, love. It's seriously addicting. Wisty and I are just about to focus our energy on an 8-year-old girl, emaciated with sickness, when my sister looks up as if coming out of a trance. Wisty, I say, irritated. We have to keep going if we want to get to everyone. But I stop when I see her face. She looks like she's seen a ghost. Is that? Wisty squints, striding across the dimly lit space. She beckons me over toward the far end, where there are an alarming number of recently vacated cots waiting to be cleaned. My sister is standing over a thin, dark-skinned girl who looks around 17. Wit, I think it's Jamila.
Chapter 24. It can't be her, my brother whispers. It's obvious what he means. The Jamila we knew, our old friend from the resistance in the house shaman back at Garfunkel's, was cheerful, vibrant, and easily more than 200 pounds. This poor plague victim has been stripped of all hope and is so emaciated by the sickness that I'm not sure her bones can even support her. I look into the sick girl's face, at her sunken cheeks and mottled skin. I recognize her corkscrew hair. Her eyes, though bloodshot, still have the depth I remember. She's a ghost of her former self, but it's Jamila, all right. Jamila, I whisper. Her eyes drift over us, unfocused. We're still all morphed out, Wit reminds me. She probably doesn't recognize us. I bend over her. Jamila, can you hear me? It's us! Wit and Wisty. You, she says hoarsely, fear creeping into her eyes. It's you! Wit looks at me uneasily. Yeah, it's us, I say, trying to sound reassuring. We're not going to hurt you. We're here to help you. She whimpers, and I want to comfort her. She's scared, really scared. Scared of us. But Jamila's tormented mind can't stay focused on us for long. Her eyes roll back and she's delirious again, mumbling about the plague of the poor and moaning names I recognize. Sasha, Janine, Emmett. I want to ask about Emmett especially, since we'd been pretty close. But there's a change in the mood of the place that's putting me on edge. Minutes ago, the kids we'd healed were lying in peace, contentedly beginning their recovery. Now, many of them have struggled out of bed and are huddled together, whispering. They have a look of utter terror in their eyes, like the Grim Reaper himself has come with his scythe to rip them from safety.
"It's Pierce for sure," a healthier boy says gravely as he sneaks back up from the first level.
The whispers are replaced by harsh silence as this sinks in. "What are they saying?" Whit asks, straining to listen to their whispers.
"No, no, not him, not—"
Jamila whimpers. Her breathing speeds up until she's hyperventilating.
"Get out,"
she rasps. I don't know if she's talking to us or them. Whit puts a cool cloth on her head, trying to calm her down, as I peek around the corner to see what is making everyone panic. Two New Order soldiers are stalking among the cots with the air of hyenas circling an injured calf. Whit and I are disguised, but my breath still quickens. There's something about the way dozens of kids are reacting to these two that makes my skin crawl. These aren't just the normal drones we see every day in the streets practicing their swagger. These men are corporate. The soldiers seem to be doing a routine inspection of some sort, working their way across the room with a clipboard. A woman, the nurse who first greeted us, is following behind them, nervously twisting her shirt in her hands. No one else moves, and the air is heavy with the smell of fear. One of them can't be much older than my brother, but he has a distinct air of authority about him. He's tall, with white blonde hair and sharp, angular features, and I'm weirdly drawn to him. He'd be really attractive if something about him didn't seem so soulless. A broad, almost garish smile plays across his face as he joins us on the second level and takes in the hordes of near-death children. And when his piercing blue eyes settle on mine, it's as if ice water is flooding my veins. I catch Whit's eye. This morph isn't going to last forever, and I sure as heck don't want to be in a claustrophobic obstacle course of a room crawling with cops when I return to my usual, conspicuously redheaded self. I start to pack up supplies as Whit whispers healing words to Jamila. But sucking the plague out of so many kids has taken a lot out of him already, and I can see that his M is weak. The soldiers are selecting beds to be wheeled into an armored truck.
"No!"
the nurse protests as they begin to cart away a weak little girl who has already started to heal. She wails, and tears spring to the nurse's eyes.
"Have you no heart? These people are sick, dying! You can't just snatch them up like rats to run your tests on."
"The one who is the one demands compliance." The soldier with the clipboard cocks an eyebrow, his young face alight with cruelty. "Unless you'd like to go in her place."
The nurse steps back, terrified, and the soldier laughs, high-pitched and haunting. And I'm reminded again of the hyena.
"Thought not."
Jamila moans in pain. "Whit," I plead, "can't you do something? We're losing her." Whit places his hands gently on her shoulders again and concentrates.
"It's no use," he sighs heavily after a minute. "She's too far gone."
The soldiers are getting closer, and our time is almost up.
"Jamila,"
I beg the dying girl. No response.
"I know you can hang in there. You're going to get out of here and see everyone you love again. Emmett, Janine."
Her eyes snap open and bore into mine with terrifying intensity. She's clutching at my arm with every bit of strength left in her frail body.
"Janine,"
she croaks.
"Janine is lost."
"What do you mean, lost?"
Whit asks harshly, and I bite my lip. Whit, don't. Just let her be.
Lost isn't dead? His voice cracks.
Lost, Jamila whispers, and then her grip on my arm slackens and her eyes flutter closed. I can't believe this is happening. Another tragedy.
Whit shakes her shoulders and I wince. What do you mean? Where's Janine? Come on!
I swear my hands are starting to look younger, paler, and soon my fiery hair will be falling around my shoulders. Not now. Please, not now.
Whit, we have to go.
And then I feel the blonde soldier's cold, calm smile on me. It's almost flirtatious, and I'm